Welcome to Health Compass. I'm your host, Maya Adam, Director of Health Media Innovation at Stanford Medicine.
You know, I've been practicing medicine for basically 20 years, and I've never seen an MRI that said somebody had 50 areas of metastases in the brain, 550. And I had that.
Today's episode is a story of resilience and a powerful case study on how to leave a legacy. It stems from the life-changing experience of one of our faculty members who went through the ultimate role reversal from doctor to patient. Bryant Lin, a beloved physician and educator at Stanford Medicine, received a shocking diagnosis in May of 2024 after he went to the doctor's office for what he thought were bad seasonal allergies. The cough he'd been experiencing was actually the manifestation of stage 4 never smoker lung cancer. After his diagnosis, Bryant, who's a clinical professor of medicine, he did something that not many patients would choose to do. He decided to openly share the course of his illness in the hopes that his story would leave an educational legacy. He developed a course for medical students and undergraduates that teaches about the complexities of cancer care from the perspective of both patient and physician. The course intimately follows his own experiences, down to the very scans that diagnosed his illness. I spoke with Bryant about his personal and professional journey, his motivation to talk about his diagnosis, and the lessons he's imparting to students around the emotional, medical, and practical challenges of providing compassionate cancer care. Bryant, welcome. It's a privilege to have this conversation with you today, and thank you so much for joining me.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Bryant, your story is an incredible one, but before we dive into kind of the journey that you've faced over the past few months, I wonder if you can tell us a bit about the path you followed to get to where you are in your career.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've taken somewhat atypical path, but you know, at Stanford, seems like everybody takes an atypical path into medicine. I studied engineering at MIT, electrical engineering, computer science, and got my master's. Wasn't sure what I wanted to do. Worked for a brief year in management consulting. Did not find that very satisfying, to say the least. Decided to go to medical school. Went to Tufts. Went to Tufts, which at the time was called New England Medical Center, for residency. And then after finishing, when I was in my last year of residency, I reached out to Paul Wong, who was my mentor at Tufts, and he had gone to Stanford during my intern year. And I reached out to him, and he let me know about the biodesign program. So I came to Stanford to be a postdoc cardiac research fellow with Paul and a biodesign fellow for a year. And then I joined the faculty in 2006, sort of a part-time primary care faculty, and I gradually increased my time there. And so far I've been, you know, early on was working on a lot of medical devices, medical technology, working with companies and research in the space. Since I've been, you know, this is my 20th year, I think, at Stanford. And since I've been here, I started the consultative medicine clinic, which was the diagnostic clinic. Also started to take students and residents on home visits before COVID. Hopefully we'll restart them, but we had to stop because of COVID. And then 6 years ago with Dr. Latha Palaniappan, I co-founded the Center for Asian Health Research and Education. And one of our priority areas was and is raising awareness and resources for education and research for lung cancer and never smokers, which differently impacts the Asian community. And of course, ironically, I have become the poster child for this effort as well.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the never smoker lung cancer and also about how it differentially impacts Asian populations?
Absolutely. So, you know, lung cancer, the number one cause of cancer death in the US and the world, up to 20% are actually never smokers or non-smokers, not active smokers. And Asians, especially Asian women, have a higher risk of getting never smoker lung cancer than other groups. And what happens is most Asians, so over 50% of Asians, they have a specific tumor mutation called an EGFR, epidermal growth factor receptor mutation. Whereas in non-Hispanic whites, it's actually less than 20% have that mutation. So, it definitely impacts the Asian community in different ways. Increased risk among Asian women, and again, this preponderance of people with this very specific mutation. We don't know why it happens. So this is a common question I get asked, and I've asked myself. We don't know why this disease presents differently, is different in Asian populations. There have been lots of theories around cooking oil, cooking exposure, natural gas exposure. But it seems like family history is a strong predictor. There was a large study in Taiwan, probably the largest of its kind, looking at using a low-dose CT to screen for lung cancer in never smokers, in both men and women 55 and up. And they looked at things like, family history, cooking exposure, mm-hmm. Unvented cooking, a kitchen, lack of ventilation, secondhand smoke exposure. And they found, again, the strongest predictor among the groups was having a family history. So that is very interesting. It's definitely an area of interest for our center, for me personally, of course. I've benefited from the advances in treatment for this EGFR mutation, and hopefully we'll bring more attention and resources. So when I need a new treatment, it'll be available for me.
Mm-hmm. Brian, on that topic, can you tell us about the past few months?
Yeah, absolutely. So, this all started in the spring, and I had a cough. It was a dry cough. I've had a long history of allergies, and I thought it was just allergy related. I felt like a little tight, maybe a little wheezy. I thought, geez, maybe I'm developing, allergy related asthma. And so I tried different inhalers. Of course, eventually tried an antibiotic, and then eventually got a chest X-ray and then a CT and get diagnosed via bronchoscopy. And it's been, of course, just a crazy ride. I was before Memorial Day, I was supposed to get my first treatment. First IV chemotherapy. So because of a new study that was done last year called the FLAURA2 trial, it showed that if you're on chemotherapy plus oral targeted therapy with a medication called osimertinib, the brand name's Tagrisso, those patients do better, stage 4 patients do better than if just doing the targeted therapy itself. And so before that, a lot of stage 4 patients were just put on the targeted therapy if they had the EGFR mutation. So because I'm in otherwise good health, I started that. They gave me an IV antiemetic, and unfortunately I had an anaphylactic reaction to that. I had to go to the hospital. I had a syncopal episode, had to go to the hospital. This was right before Memorial Day, and I had a lot of fluid in my lungs, pleural effusion. They drained 1.8 liters out from my right lung. And finally, was discharged after a day, got excellent care, and I continue to get excellent care at Stanford. And after that, I was able to, the Tuesday after Memorial Day, was able to start my chemotherapy every 3 weeks. And so I got a combination chemotherapy at first, and now I'm on pemetrexed alone with a daily oral therapy. And, I've been very grateful because my cancer has responded. It's by no means gone, but it has responded. It has, some areas have shrunk. It's definitely not progressed. One thing that was frightening to me was, I've been practicing medicine for basically 20 years, and I've never seen an MRI that said somebody had 50 areas of metastases in the brain, 55-0. Wow. And I had that. So that was quite shocking to see I had 50. I mean, I expected, lung cancer tends to be diagnosed late stage because people are very asymptomatic until the later stage. So I was expecting metastases, which I had, to the liver, to different areas, to the skin even. But I wasn't expecting 50 areas of metastases to the brain. And fortunately, my second MRI showed that they had all gone except maybe for one. And then my third MRI showed there was no evidence of intracranial metastatic disease. But I still have two lung masses, two lung nodules, mass in my liver and areas of my bone that are impacted. But I feel well. I'm very grateful. I feel well. I can teach. I can see patients. You know, I never took a day off work, actually, since this all started. The only concession I've made to cancer so far is to switch my patients to video instead of in person, so I don't get sick by unintentionally get sick. So I'm very grateful that I've been able to do everything I want to do so far.
Bryant, you know, in hearing you speak, I'm just reflecting on the choices we make. And I think sometimes in times of crisis, many people would choose to sort of retreat and focus on their own personal challenges, and others will advance and sort of focus on catalyzing solutions for even bigger populations and bigger questions. And since learning about your diagnosis, you've decided to teach a whole course around cancer care and treatment. And you've given multiple interviews about your experience. I think you're writing a book. I'm curious about the motivation to share your journey.
Yeah, I think there are many motivations. One is, of course, you know, I tend to be the kind of person that tries to make lemonade from lemons, you know, taking such a terrible thing and finding a benefit from it so other people can benefit. I find, at least in my mind, you know, if I were a medical student, I would have loved to hear from somebody with one foot in both worlds. I still remember on my first day of medical school, you know, this famous neurologist brought in a patient who he had not seen and, you know, did some, you know, I don't even remember what it was, you know, did some physical exam maneuvers and actually caused the patient a little bit of pain and then gave him this unusual diagnosis. So, of course, all the students were like, oh, this is amazing. You know, what an awesome doctor. But I still remember that case because the patient felt pain. So I was like, well, what about the patient? What's the patient feeling? You know, you're bringing this patient in front of all these people. It's such an odd situation there. And, you know, we're here to take care of patients. So, you know, I've always been a believer in learning about the patient journey and the patient stories. You know, as an educational exercise, bring students and residents to home visits. And so I think sharing that perspective as both a physician and a patient would be educational. And that also informed how we structured the class. 95% of your life as a patient is not, you know, appointments, getting tests, getting treatment, right? A lot of it's living your life with this disease and, of course, side effects from the treatment. So, you know, in addition to the regular things like, you know, screening, epidemiology, treatment, we also look at caregiving, you know, spiritual care, nutrition, mental health, access. So all of these things that are not traditionally directly medical. I mean, nutrition is, but, you know, there's a long history in medicine of not, you know, not emphasizing nutritional education around nutrition as much as we should. So, you know, that's kind of what inspired me to teach the class. And so far, the students have been very engaged and seem to have benefited from it. And again, I think I've learned as much as the students because the way the class is structured is we have a topic of the day. I share my part of the story or my reflections on that topic. And then we have an expert come in to talk about, you know, screening or diagnosis or treatment or nutrition or spiritual care. So I've learned a lot myself, and hopefully the students find it beneficial.
Mm-hmm. And I heard that at one point your wife even joined one of the classes and shared her experience, just getting back to what you said about how patients are living their lives outside of the clinic as well. Can you tell me a little bit about what that experience was like to have your wife take part in the class?
Yeah, I mean, when we decided to have a caregiving session, I said, well, we have to have my wife because she's my primary caregiver at home. She takes great care of me. She's my rock, provides both kind of logistical caregiving, but also, you know, emotional support for me. And so, yeah, it's lovely to have my wife in the class and to have her share this experience that I get to have, which is teaching students. So it was really wonderful to have that perspective. The other caregiver we invited, he is a father of a a young woman. His daughter has severe cancer. And, you know, he also provided a great perspective because he actually didn't identify with the label caregiver. You know, this is some mm-hmm. a medical label we put on people for research. And, you know, we like to assign categories. And, you know, for him, he's like, I'm a father, right? I'm a father. I'm not a caregiver. I'm a father. And being a father is being a father. And there's all these things associated with him being a father. And maybe and caring, of course, is part of that. But he really identified with being a father and not a caregiver. So, you know, hearing those varied perspectives and, you know, having the students think about, you know, how we categorize and label people was very important, but also sharing that lived experience of what it is to take care of a cancer patient was very important.
Has it shifted the dynamic? I mean, how has it changed that taking on that role of, let's say, caregiver, just, you know, because it's the label we started with? How has that shifted and how does it shift the day-to-day lives of people who, you know, have a relationship prior to that that doesn't involve the caregiver piece?
Yeah, I think there's a huge variation, honestly. Yeah, I think there are some people who, you know, who I'm fortunately, at the beginning I was quite sick, but, you know, I had some functional limitations. And now I don't have too many functional limitations other than, you know, side effects from chemotherapy, you know, nausea and fatigue and things like that. So I would say in our lives, it hasn't really changed much other than, you know, she's taking care of me, which she did before, but, you know, it's a different context. It's making sure I eat well. And, you know, I'm eating foods that, you know, would not at least increase my risk of getting cancer or getting worse cancer. You know, being present and so forth. So I would say those parts don't change, but the context changes. I can definitely see, of course, you know, as a physician, you know, if you're taking care of somebody and my mother has advanced dementia and my father takes care of her, you know, that does change the dynamic quite a lot because there's a lot of functional changes, functional help. You know, you're helping them with their activities of daily living. So that can change the dynamic quite significantly. That hasn't been the case for me because of my functional status has been quite good. You know, people will look at me and I can tell you, you know, having gone to med school 20 plus years ago, you know, if you told me that I look like I'm a stage 4 cancer patient, I'd say no way, right? You know, at that time, especially, you know, stage 4 cancer patients were quite sick. And that has really drastically changed over the last 20 plus years. So, you know, I'm grateful that I am very functional and, you know, have great relationships and great support. And, you know, I really recognize how privileged I am, right, to be, you know, we talked about healthcare access in our class, right? And one of the things I brought up that the students hadn't thought of, you know, when I asked them, hey, what do you think why do you think I was able to get good care? Of course, they're like, well, you're a doctor, you know people, blah, blah, blah. You have insurance. And, you know, I pointed out, and these are great. They covered most of the reasons, but I said, hey, I speak English, you know, I speak English, right? And people who don't speak English well or speak English at all are, you know, have challenges and barriers to care. So I recognize that I'm in a quite privileged group where, you know, even though it's challenging, you know, I have the support and resources to get excellent care and so that my caregivers can really hopefully not be overly burdened with my care. Mm-hmm.
And Brian, the second week, I think, of your class focused on how to have difficult conversations as a physician. I wonder what your actual experience of that has been and how you communicate that to how can you teach those skills to your students?
This is something that does honestly take some experience, and everyone develops their own style and their own process for having a difficult conversation with a patient. And there's a balance to be had. There's a balance between being straightforward, because it's hard. People hear what they want to hear, and you're getting with cancer, such a complicated diagnosis, right? So many things involved. But, you know, you want to be also, and this is something maybe has changed since getting my cancer diagnosis, you also want to be hopeful, right? It's very easy, especially during our training, to relay things like survival curves and statistics and prognosis. And, you know, as speaking as a cancer patient, you know, it doesn't really help anybody to really think about that. Geez, I have a 10% likelihood of surviving the next 5 years, right? Because otherwise you would just kind of give up, right? Just make yourself miserable. So maintaining that hope is very important, I think, for the patient. We had a guest yesterday. So the topic yesterday was on mental health and cancer stories. And early on, I spoke to Dr. Davies Wong, who's a pulmonologist out of Sharp. And he was introduced to me by a medical school classmate who's also a pulmonologist. And he said, you know, as a day-to-day ICU doctor, he said, yeah, I used to be, you know, he deals with life and death literally every day. You know, he used to be a little bit more blunt and straightforward about prognosis, but, you know, given his experience as someone who is a lung cancer survivor, you know, he really is also been more cognizant of how hope plays into the picture. So there's that balance there, and it's tricky. I do think this is something that, you know, we give advice and guidance, and we have an interview guide for students, but some of this has to come through experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a primary care provider, in a way it's a little easier for me because most of my patients I've known for years, if not more than a decade. So that does change the dynamic as well compared to somebody you just met.
And Brian, you mentioned a few minutes ago, spirituality and the importance of spirituality. Can you tell us how that plays a part and why it's so important for a medical team to incorporate a patient's spiritual needs?
Absolutely. You know, I'm not a religious person. At most, I would call myself agnostic. And I never thought of myself as a spiritual person. But the reason we added that session in our class was, you know, I was overwhelmed by how many people reached out to me and said they would pray for me. They would pray with me. They would bring their pastor. They would light a candle for me. People from different religions. I had people send me, you know, Hindu chants. I had a friend send me a yantra, which is a little object to focus your meditation around. You know, had people who practice Buddhism kind of talk about how they would, you know, also practice their religion and chant and, you know, observe Buddhist practices for me. And I found that very comforting. I found that really deeply moved me that people would bring their own spiritual practices and spiritual care for the support of me. And, you know, day to day, the questions that come up when you have stage 4 cancer, which is not considered curable, they're really metaphysical questions, right? They're really spiritual questions, right? There's a practical component of, well, you know, every day I ask myself, how do I want to spend today? Is this a good use of my time, right? Should I spend my time, you know, seeing patients and, you know, talking to media and, you know, or should I be doing something different, right? And so I reassess that every day. And fortunately, the answer generally has been the same. Is like, you know, I enjoy what I'm doing and I find benefit from it personally. And hopefully I'm benefiting other people. So I'll continue doing this. So I think that part really has shown to me how important that spiritual side is. You know, it's not all about facts and numbers and, you know, treatment. And the great advice that also from Dr. Wong, you know, he said, well, don't look at the survival curves. And you just have to think, geez, I can live long enough till the next treatment comes out, right? But, you know, day to day, you still think about what do I value? What do I hope for? What are my hopes and dreams? You know, I don't plan out 5 years anymore, but, you know, I still think about those issues, which are deeply rooted in spiritual care and spiritual belief. I was kind of interested about how, you know, spiritual care is not brought up in medicine at all. You know, we have chaplains and so forth. So one thing I found out was chaplaincy services are generally not covered by insurance. So hospitals are paying for these chaplains themselves or relying on volunteer chaplains. I was also interested, so I did a search on PubMed. You know, PubMed is a kind of big index for medical articles. And I typed in chemotherapy, and there are 400,000 articles, right, as expected. And then I typed in not even spiritual care, just spiritual. And there are 8,000 articles. So, you know, it's interesting how we don't value the spiritual, at least on a research basis, right? Even though I would say, I would argue that a lot of people would say that spiritual care is at least as important as the chemotherapy they're getting.
Is there, how much evidence is there, if any, for the role of, for example, hope in cancer care or spirituality? Do we have any science?
Yeah, I think there is some science between positive thinking and better outcomes. I think so. You know, so these are a lot of the unknowns, but I don't think it's studied as well enough as I would like, honestly, right? First of all, I mean, it's, as a researcher, it's difficult to study, right? How do you assess this, right? People are self-reporting how they feel or their optimism and so forth. And, you know, these are self-reported subjective assessments. And then, you know, what outcome are you looking for, right? You know, all the outcomes are interesting, but are you looking for outcomes like mortality, which are, you know, hard outcomes to move? Are you looking for outcomes like morbidity, you know, hospitalizations, or quality of life, right? Are you, you know, what's important? What are we putting priorities on? So one, yes, I think there is some evidence that positive thinking is helpful. You know, two, it's not magic by any means. But three, you know, that may reflect your, you know, engagement of other things as well, right? There may be a lot of confounders about, you know, if you're positive, maybe you're more likely to take your medicine, right? Maybe you're more likely to take care of yourself, right? So there may be other factors which are hard to quantify and to capture. So I definitely think there should be research in this. I think there should be also, you know, mechanistic research, right? Why, you know, how does it change your brain? I'm sure there's been functional MRI studies on people in prayer and other areas. But, you know, I'm also very confident, without having done an in-depth literature review, that we probably don't have that much research in the area. You know, it's not typically the area where, you know, you get a lot of NIH grants or other funding, which really drives our research ecosystem, right?
Brian, for any listeners who are basically hearing this story and sort of seeing themselves in your experience, is there anything you'd want to specifically say to them? Any advice you'd give to them?
Yeah, I think, you know, storytelling is powerful. And, you know, we humans have a great ability to generalize from other people's stories and find that connection, even though they may have a different type of cancer. I'm not a big believer in advice, you know, but I do believe, you know, this is something where this is a time, if you get a cancer diagnosis, it's a great time to really reflect, to get help, to gather your village around you, because it's so complicated to get cancer care now, and to find your support both on a physical basis. You know, people are amazing and they'll offer to cook food for you and you'll have a freezer full of food that people will give you. But also on a, you know, an emotional, spiritual basis, right? Getting that support. I was just on a panel about doctors who've faced cancer diagnoses, either currently or in the past. And, you know, even people who have been treated and are in remission, you know, some of them struggle with kind of reintegrating their lives back. Some of them struggle with guilt. So, you know, I can say that, you know, I think a broader support system is, I mean, I can't imagine that would not be helpful. I think share your story if you find it helpful. Like some people are, you know, I get that question a lot. Why are you sharing your story? Because there's a little bit of a stigma in a way I've seen behind sharing your story or diagnoses of any illness, right? But, you know, in certain people, it may be helpful to share their story, and your story may help other people. So I don't know if this is great advice, but these are kind of my reflections on your question.
You know, I'm thinking as I'm listening to you speak that sometimes in sharing your own vulnerability, you can showcase the most unimaginable strength.
I suspect so. I think the benefit of sharing is, you know, of course, they're multifold, right? Benefits of, you know, getting having to think about it, having to synthesize your thoughts, right? Put it into a recording or on paper, you know, communicating what you're going through, you know, that generally has been found to be helpful in, you know, areas such as narrative medicine for both physicians and for patients. I do think that, you know, that could be a way that they're, you know, getting control. So speaking of strength, you know, that could be a way, and this was talked about in our panel today. One of the guests was came to give grand rounds, and, you know, that is a way that you can regain control of your own story, right? In cancer, you're so subject to other forces, right? Mm-hmm. That you have no control over, but telling your story could be one way you regain at least a small part of that control.
I am so grateful to you for joining us today, and thank you for everything that you're doing, for the legacy that you're leaving, and you're an inspiration. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Stanford Medicine's Health Compass podcast. If you like what you heard today and want to keep up with Health Compass, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Stanford Medicine YouTube channel, or wherever you like to listen.